Welcome to the resumption of the Sunday evening call-ins after the Veterans Day holiday. This is Jim Breeling, and we've got, before I get into our talk, a couple of relevant announcements here. A recent paper of which Mary Zanarini was one of the co-authors, and Mary presented before the Veterans Day break on her long-term follow-up. In this paper, they looked at depression and borderline personality disorder among adolescents for the risk of suicidal ideation and deliberate self-harm. And borderline personality disorder diagnosis among adolescents significantly enhanced and increased that prediction, which points up the importance with adolescents of looking for the disorder. Kind of a nice addition to get clinicians to attend to this among adolescents. In another paper, the investigators looked at structural brain features, similarities and differences between bipolar disorder and borderline personality disorder. And as most of you know, there's a lot of confusion there clinically that often borderlines get diagnosed as bipolar, get inappropriate medications that don't help, may do harm, and don't get appropriate treatment. So making that distinction is a very important one, and the investigators here found some commonalities in the structural brain features, as you might expect with two orders that share some emotional dysregulation, but also some significant differences that pointed up and that were in line with what you'd expect from the disorder. This isn't the only thing, and people are not going to be doing structural brain imaging to differentiate between the diagnosis. But the second investigator, who was funded through NARSET with benefit of funds raised by Families for Borderline Personality Disorder Research, is doing a lot more work on this, both at the diagnostic features in terms of symptoms as well as brain features, to help clarify that that important distinction. So it's kind of exciting to see these things popping up in the literature. Wanted to mention also that the meeting that was sold out on dialectics of validation with Dr. Alan Frassetti, who's one of the most popular presenters in the field, had to be canceled and rescheduled because of the Sandy Frankenstorm, has been rescheduled for December 7th, and that is, more information is up in the upper left-hand corner on the NEA BBT webpage. There's also early bird registration open for a March 22nd conference next year on adolescence borderline disorder. And I mentioned this early bird because all the conferences have been selling out. So it really is true that the early bird will get the worm of being able to attend. And then videos are now available from a March 9th conference this year on adolescent personality disorder, again through the NEA BBT webpage. And then another addition is a nice one from, the videos are available from the Healing Hearts of Families of Personality Borderline Personality Disorder, a meeting that was sold out, and our presenter tonight was a presenter for that conference, and the video of her presentation is there. And all these, are available free. It's an open access thing, but they do cost money to have it up and operate the website. So when you use these, if you're in a position to, it's an honor system, to consider the value to you of having this 24/7 access to this material and being able to access it from the comfort of your home or your office at the time and day of your choice. And do consider making a donation because there are real financial costs to making these available, and it's an honor system. We hope that you will be honorable. And thank you in advance for your support. Our presenter tonight really comes highly recommend it. The people who I have talked to who have heard her present are just really enthused about it. And Carla Sharp is from South Africa, got her major training there, went on to Oxford in developmental psychopathology in addition to clinical psychology, and now is a well-established resident of Texas in the United States, where she is pursuing focus on adolescent personality disorder. Let me stop there and turn it over to Dr. Sharp.
Thank you so much, Jim, and I want to thank you and Perry and NEOPPD for this wonderful invitation. It's such a wonderful series. We've just been talking about how long it's been going on, and it's such a pleasure to be part of the lineup. I don't want to delay any further. I want us to get to speak about this, and hopefully there'll be some chance for some questions from the audience. I'm going to speak about borderline personality disorder in children and adolescents. I'm going to go straight to slide 2. This was published, this is a paper published by Andrew Channon in 2008, and Andrew Channon is a big borderline personality disorder researcher, specifically for adolescents, and I chose to copy and paste this title of his paper in here because it shows how we have been thinking about BPD for a very long time in adolescence. He titled this paper, Personality Disorder in Adolescence, The Diagnosis That Dare Not Speak Its Name. And I would say even up until about 5 years ago, whenever I tried to publish a paper on borderline personality disorder in children and adolescents, I had to include a paragraph talking about the controversy of personality disorder diagnosis in adolescents. Recently, as I have published more and more, I've seen that reviewers and journals have become less insistent on that paragraph talking about the controversy in borderline personality disorder because over the last 5 to 10 years, we've been seeing a huge empirical basis developing for the validity of BPD in children and adolescents. But before this 5 to 10 year period, people were very reluctant to diagnose or even think about diagnosing children and adolescents with borderline traits or borderline personality disorder. People were concerned mostly about two things. The first thing is the fact that some data has shown that personality is not yet stable until early adulthood. And then other studies have pointed out or raised the concern that there's a stigma associated with borderline personality disorder, and therefore these two factors led to some reluctance in for clinicians and others to diagnose BPD in kids. However, the other side of this argument is that, number one, parents will tell you that their child did not wake up at 18 and suddenly had a personality disorder, that there were clear signs and symptoms preceding the onset of the disorder, so precursors of the disorder early on. And secondly, we do now know that personality disorder is actually not as stable in adults as previously thought of. And so, in some ways, we may be doing adolescents a disservice if we do not acknowledge signs and symptoms early, because they won't get the right treatment, and we may be actually doing them a disservice in this way. So there are two sides to this argument. Given the empirical basis that has been developing over the last 5 to 10 years, I think folks have started feeling more comfortable talking about BPD, at least in adolescents, and clinicians are a little bit more open to consider it as a diagnosis. So what I'm going to present today is data on the validity of the disorder. I'm going to move to slide 3 there. And let's just talk about when is a disorder valid. Now, Robinson Goos in 1970 laid down five criteria for the validity of psychiatric disorder, and these five criteria were actually very, very influential in the establishment and development of the DSM-3, which was the forerunner of the DSM-4 in the way that we now know the DSM classification system. And so five criteria were laid down by Robinson Goos. The first one was that for a disorder to be valid, you need to be able to describe it. So clinical description was number one. Establishing that a disorder represents a syndrome of symptoms that can be empirically shown to co-occur. And I always use the example of a cold. You've got a runny nose, you're coughing, you've got teary eyes. Those are symptoms that hang together, and if you've got all of those symptoms, then you know that you've got a cold. If you add fever to that mix, then you think to yourself, well, actually, I may not have a cold, I may have a flu. So clinical description being the first criterion for when a disorder is valid. Number two, lab studies, and most often these would be biological lab studies or correlates, cognitive, neurocognitive correlates of a disorder. And you need to be able to show that there are unique biological substrates underlying a disorder for the disorder to be considered valid. A lot of research, of course, has been carried out in this area since the 1990s with the advances in neuroscience technology. Borderline has been a bit slower than depression and anxiety, but certainly there's been a big growth in these studies. But so lab studies is the second criterion. Number three, delimitation from other disorders. We need to be able to show that BPD is different from depression, anxiety, conduct disorder, externalizing, substance use, for it to be considered a valid disorder. And this is no easy feat. If we look back at even the history for anxiety and depression, we know that it's quite hard to demonstrate delimitation in from different disorders. But that is the third criteria, and we need to hold our BPD research to that standard. Fourth, follow-up studies. We need to be able to show a common course to symptom patterns across individuals. So if the symptom constellation of a cold differs from year one to year two to year three, that will call into question whether we're really dealing with a cold. Now, there have been concepts that have been developed, such as heterotypic continuity versus homotypic continuity, that tries and gets at how disorders may change over time. And we know that for BPD, for instance, there is a trajectory where kids may start out as a little bit more externalizing pre-adolescent, then going into internalizing symptoms, and then the disorder culminates in a combination of externalizing and internalizing in young adulthood. But the point here is that we need to be able to show a common course to symptom patterns across individuals for a disorder to be, so some homotypic continuity, there needs to be a core essential feature of BPD that needs to be consistent over time. Otherwise, we will call into question its validity. And then number five, family studies. We need to be able to show that there is some genetic basis to the biological phenomenon that we study in the disorder, some genetic basis perhaps to emotion regulation or to interpersonal difficulties and so on. So I must say at this point that the Robinson Goos criteria that influenced the DSM-3 and then 4 and 4TR are, of course, taking a categorical approach to the disorder. And by setting up my talk in this way, I by no means want to solely ascribe to a categorical approach to diagnosis. There's been a vibrant debate going on over the last few years with the DSM-5 preparations, and the value of the dimensional approach is without question. However, it is helpful to just go back and think about how did we in the past consider a disorder to be valid, and how has this influenced the research that I'm going to talk about now in the next few slides. So what we've been doing, I'm going to go on to slide four now, what we've been doing in my lab at University of Houston in collaboration with the Menninger Clinic has been to focus just on these two first points, the clinical description of BPD in adolescents and then lab studies, and specifically social cognitive correlates of BPD in adolescence. And so what I'm going to talk about for the next almost 35 minutes would be these two points. On to slide 5. So the questions I'll be asking is, can one accurately assess and identify BPD in children and adolescents? And I there's one sample that I'll talk about that will be pre-adolescent. And this is then an important question. Can we validly, reliably assess and identify BPD in children and adolescents? And secondly, how do we understand the development or early precursors of BPD? Can we validate some of the theories that have been around for 50 years about how BPD develops in children and adolescents, the precursors that develop into a full disorder in early adulthood? Slide 6 is really just acknowledging the huge role that the Menninger Clinic has played in our research. Slide 7 as well, that's my lab over at University of Houston, but at the bottom there you see Peter Fonagy, who's been a consultant to our work at the Adolescent Treatment Program since 2008, Liz Newland, who is the director, medical director at ATP, and Chris Free, who's the director of research at the Menninger Clinic. And so just a big thank you to the Menninger Clinic and all the people that help us with this research program. On to slide 8 then. So we're going to start with the heaviest piece of research, which made use of item response theory analysis of the 9 borderline criteria, DSM-4 borderline criteria, in a population-based sample of 11 to 12-year-old children. And you'll see I intentionally have the paper headings there so that people have it and they can go and find it. People are also very welcome to contact me directly and I can send them copies of a paper. So the aims, I'm going to go on to slide 9 there. The aims then of this paper was to evaluate the dimensional structure of BPD criteria in youth using categorical factor analysis. And here what we mean by that is that we want to see whether the 9 criteria lie on a dimension and all give equal value to the construct of BPD. We wanted to evaluate whether all of the items all of this criteria, as they become items in a measure, an interview-based measure, whether they all add to the diagnosis of BPD. Does BPD hang together as one syndrome? Remember Robbins and Goose's first criteria, do the symptoms hang together as one syndrome and one disorder? So that was aim 1. Aim 2, examine the utility of each individual BPD criterion through 2 separate statistical approaches, use of IRT, and then we also looked at PPP and NPP. These are sensitivities, positive predictive power and negative predictive power. I don't think I'll be presenting that tonight. And then we wanted to test differential item functioning across gender. And those on the call will be aware of the fact that for a long time we have held the view that BPD is more prevalent among women than men. Data over the last few years have suggested that BPD may be as prevalent among men, but women just come to the clinic more often than men, and therefore we've seen this pattern. But actually, we know very little about gender differences, and certainly we know little about gender differences in adolescents. So that was another aim of this particular study. On slide 10, I give specifics about the study participants. This was a large sample. It's part of a big longitudinal study in England called the ELSPAC study. You'll see 7,149 children. These are pre-adolescent, so 11-year-old children, about 50-50 boys and girls, were evaluated using the child interview for BPD, for borderline personality disorder, that Mary Zanarini developed and published in 2003. And it's an interview-based measure of BPD, and it goes through the 9 criteria in a systematic way with prompts for each criteria. And you'll see most of the sample was Caucasian, mean age then 11.75. And here is the biggest finding, that only 0.66% of the children met 5 criteria or above. So if we think about prevalence rates, this is a huge sample, so we can make these conclusions. If we think about prevalence rates in adults, which lies between 1 and 2%, with some studies finding higher, we do see then in this age range of 11-year-olds a lower prevalence rate. This is not to say that many kids would not be below threshold, and we are looking at this data set to potentially write a sub-threshold paper and see what are the trajectory of these sub-threshold children compared to the children, these 42 kids out of 6,000 kids who ended up meeting criteria. The next slide then, slide 11, there's a lot of findings here, but what I want to draw your attention to for boys and girls are the three models that we tested. So model one was a unidimensional model where we say that BPD is underlied by one factor. So all symptoms of BPD, all the nine criteria of BPD load onto one single factor. And those of you that's very familiar with the research on BPD will know that there's been different models put forward for the underlying structure for BPD. Some people have suggested two factors. Some people have suggested three factors. The Saner's Law is the very famous one with three factors, with affective instability, interpersonal problems, and impulsivity. And what this slide shows, that for boys and girls, the best fit statistics are for model one, the unidimensional model. I'm going to go on to slide 12. In terms of dimensionality then, we see that the factor model, the one factor model, is most parsimonious. Even if you look at the two factor and the three factor models, the correlation between those factors are so high, with 0.96 for boys in the two factor model, 0.85 and 97 in the three factor model, that it really suggests a one-factor model. So just confirming again this idea of a one-factor model, and that is important because it means that the disorder hangs together in this very tight way. It's actually also consistent with some recent data in adults when you do use an IRT model. So an IRT model is different from previous factor analytic approaches in that it takes a latent trait approach. It's model fitting versus trying to extract factors from the data in a classical test theory fashion. If we then go on to slide 13, this is just a summary that the single factor model fit well. The unidimensional factor structure is consistent with adult BPD literature. BPD criteria constitute a coherent combination of traits and symptoms even in early pre-teenage youth. So if this, and this is probably the most important finding from the study, if this was random in youth, we wouldn't see the symptoms hanging together in this unidimensional way in 11-year-olds. So yes, we see that the prevalence rate was low, but that the symptoms hang together in the same way we expect for adults. And that's the important take-home message here. Further, consistent with a growing trend to view psychiatric diagnoses as continuously distributed, and dimensional perspective may be better able to account for developmental fluctuations. Remember again that the prevalence rate was so low, but because the disorder hangs together in this unidimensional way, we can start looking at sub-threshold symptoms and look at what that might predict in kids. The next slide on 14, this talks about the discrimination parameter of the IRT findings. And this is the question it asks here is whether each criterion discriminates well for boys and for girls, or whether there are criterion that do not do a good job of this. And what this shows, or this slide just summarizes, is that there was good discrimination of all the symptoms or all the criteria for boys and girls. Thresholds, this was interesting. Here we see some differentiation for boys and girls. Abandonment fears and suicidal behaviors were the most difficult symptoms. That means in IRT language that they were harder to endorse for boys and girls. So, and this would make sense because suicidal behavior is not so prevalent in the 11-year-old age range. And abandonment fears is also quite a complex emotion that may come later when you're not so tied to your parents as an 11-year-old may be. Consistent with studies showing that abandonment fears is the least commonly exhibited symptoms, and then suicide being rare. I'll go on to slide 16. that talks about the differential item functioning. So here again, we see abandonment fears and impulsivity functioning differentially in boys and girls. Boys are more likely to than girls to be rated as exhibiting uncontrolled anger and suicidal behaviors and impulsivity. Girls have more abandonment fears and unstable relationships, was also more discriminating for boys and girls. And these differences between boys and girls make sense. It could be that the CIBPD needs to be adjusted for boys and girls, so that we talk about anger in a different way when we talk about girls, or talk with girls to refer more to interpersonal anger than explicit anger or impulsivity in the same way. How does impulsivity express itself in girls versus boys? And then, but of course, it may not lie at the level of the item wording. It may lie actually at gender stereotyping. So it may be a real difference between boys and girls. Importantly, slide 7, whichever differences we found between boys and girls at the item level or the criterion level were cancelled out at the level of the test. Those two lines, girls and boys, are exactly similar. So in other words, when we think about total scores, there's no difference between boys and girls in how BPD works in boys and girls. So that was the 9 criteria, DSM-4 criteria, and the take-home message here is that it does hang together as a coherent symptom that has a dimensional nature in 11-year-olds. Even in 11-year-olds, these are kids that are pre-adolescent. I'm going to go on to slide 18 now, the BPFSC. This is a measure that was developed by Nikki Crick. She published it in 2005. It's called the Borderline Personality Feature Scale for Children, and we tested whether this has any validity in the context of a community sample of boys, again, trying to address the limitation and lack of research in boys. Here are some examples on slide 19 of the questions. So you can see it's a Likert scale. It goes from not at all true all the way through to always true. And the teenager just chooses which one is most representative for them. So in this study, on slide 20 then, we wanted to investigate the cross-informant concordance of the BPFSC, the child version, with a newly developed parent version, and we wanted to look at the criterion validity with measures of Axis 1. So if the BPFSC was deemed valid, it would correlate with Axis 1 disorders in a particular way. We expected it to correlate with externalizing problems, so more problems in the conduct disorder range, given that these were boys, a sample of boys. So we did this in Houston with 171 second to 12 graders. They were about 50-50 in the pre-adolescent and adolescent age range. And it was a pretty diverse sample, which was an improvement from our English sample. On the next slide, you see the Spearman correlation coefficients for the psychopathology measures. And what I want to draw your attention to is the correlation between the child and the parent version. And you'll see it there in column number 2 at the bottom. You can see the child and the parent versions correlating with each other 0.24. Actually, on the right-hand side, the last two, bottom corner, right-hand corner, you'll see the correlations of 0.24. That's how the child and parent version of the BPFS correlated with each other. So that's not very, very high, but it's consistent with other studies where we do see a significant correlation between parents and kids, but it's not as high as you think. It could be a perfect correlation, would be 1. So you can see between there's a lot of limited overlap between parents and children in this regard. Now, in the literature, we know that parents and children are especially discordant where it comes to internalizing problems, and it is probably due to the fact that BPD has a large internalizing component, that we see a reduction in overlap here. when we then look at, I'm going to go to 24, slide 24, here we see the differences on the YSR. This is the youth self-report between high and low scorers determined by the BPFSP. Actually, I'm going to go back to 23 because I wanted to talk about the BPFSC first. So this is the child version. And what we see in this slide, you can look at those p-values. The BPFSC is very good at distinguishing between kids who are above threshold in the clinical range for a lot of different disorders. If we look at the BPFSCP, we see the same pattern of results, although not as good as the BPFSC. You don't see as many p-values for the t-test below 0.01 or 0.05. So drawing conclusions from this modest but significant agreement between parents and children, similar to most studies, teens themselves report significantly higher means of BPD compared to their parents, again emphasizing this idea that potentially if there is borderline going on in a teen, they are not going to share this with their parents to the extent that we would hope they would. And parents will be, to some degree, ignorant of the full extent of what is going on with a teenager. The cross-method analysis shows strong relationship with externalizing behavior. So when we, as expected, when we look at the child versions and the parent versions of psychopathology and how they correlate, that means cross-method analysis, then we see a strong relationship with externalizing behavior for BPD, which is what one expects in a sample of boys. I'm going to go to the third measure. So just to recap, we've talked about the CIBPD, Mary Zanarini's measure. I'll come back to that again. We talked about the BPFSC, Borderline Personality Disorder Feature Scale, and here we're going to just talk about the BPFSC and its criterion validity. So this is not looking at it in relation to Axis 1, but whether it is good at identifying children who would be above cutoff on an interview-based measure of BPD, which we consider to be the gold standard. So here the aims, this is 27, was the criterion validity, again, standardized interview. 28 just shows you the demographics, and this is one of the first studies that we published off the Adolescent Treatment Program data set at the Menninger Clinic. And you can see it's not a very diverse sample. The mean age was about 16. We had more girls and more boys than girls. That has since changed with more girls on the unit. 29 then is the rock curve, and what you want to see in a good measure is that the curves go towards the left-hand corner. And when you look at the parent version, you'll see that's the one that's a bit more squiggly. It's not performing quite as well as the child version in predicting who's above cutoff on Mary Zanarini's child interview of BPD. On the next slide of 30, we determined a cutoff point around 65, which we have since been using in other studies. So if you are using the BPFSC, you don't have time to use the CIBPD, the interview-based measure, then you can use the self-report measure, and you can use the cutoff of 65. This will need to be replicated in a community sample. So deriving cutoff scores in a clinical sample may be biasing our information because of the severity of the sample. So this should be done in a community sample to verify this cutoff score. But in the meantime, it's probably a good ballpark figure to use for folks who don't have time to be using the BPFSC in their clinical practice or their research. On slide 31, we come back to the CIBPD. And here we did a big study. You'll see what I have printed there or pasted there is the proof of this that was came out very recently. And on 32, you see the first item of the CIBPD. And you can see the criterion, inappropriate anger, the first criterion that we want to pull for is in bold there at the bottom, and all the prompts that an interviewer will ask precedes the criterion. Typically, Mary's Anne Arie trains folks to use this measure, and she goes through a systematic training process in order to make sure that people are well trained in this. We record all the interviews, and then we determine inter-rate reliability when we use this. So here we just wanted to set out and do a validation of the CIBPD. We looked at the internal construct validities through Cronbach's alpha and through factor analysis. We looked at the inter-rate reliability, the criterion validity with other measures of BPD, the PAI, the BPFSC, and then also, again, the Achenbach scales, as well as the CDISC, the diagnostic interview schedule, so a diagnostic measure of Axis 1 disorder, Kim Gratz's deliberate self-harm inventory, and then Gratz's DERS, difficulties in emotion regulation. If we were to be able to show correlations with all of these external measures, that would speak to the validity of the CIBPD. And we looked at it both categorically and dimensionally. The participants then, this was slide 34, with 190 inpatients, mean age 15, 59 females, very Caucasian sample, which is a limitation of this sample. Slide 35, you see the results of the CFA. And here we confirm again what we did in the big UK sample, that a one-factor model fits the data the best. This is, again, an exciting finding because it shows that this disorder lies on a dimension, one dimension. If we look at the factor loadings, you can see they're fairly high factor loadings for all of the measures, with unstable relationships having the highest factor loading, going down to impulsivity and paranoid ideation having the lowest factor loadings. Cronbach's alpha was decent. The inter-rate reliability was good on 15%, 89. If we then go on to slide 36, in terms of the criterion validity for clinician diagnosis, we had an acceptable kappa. We had demonstrated higher means for the BPFSP, BPFSC. And then also on the PAI, we showed higher means for those above cutoff on affective instability, identity problems, negative relationships, and self-harm. So all speaking to the criterion validity of the CIBPD. You'll see next correlational, so looking at it dimensionally, not through a t-test, but dimensionally through correlations. And that slide 37 shows correlations significant with the DERS, with the PAI board, the BPFSC, BPFSP. When we looked at Axis 1, again, higher means for the CBCL. This is the parent-rated internalizing and externalizing and total problems. That's on slide 38. Same with YSR, self-report internalizing and externalizing and total problems. And same with suicide ideation, NSSI, and emotion dysregulation. So really, so far, the CIBPD is performing very, very well. If we looked at it from a correlational, so dimensional point of view, again, slide 39, you can see it's correlating very well with the YSR, the CBCL, and the DERS. Finally, on slide 40, we see when we use the DISC, so diagnostic interview schedule for children, we also see higher significant chi-squares with anxiety, depression, eating, and externalizing disorder. So this all speaks to the CIBPD's validity, and we have now so much experience with this measure that I can recommend it highly. I do think it's a gold standard at this stage in the field. Going on to slide 41, this is the MSI, also a measure developed by Mary Zanarini, the McLean screening inventory for BPD. And you'll see the 10 questions there. So this was developed because, obviously, the CIBPD takes a long time. We find it takes between 30 and 40 minutes to do. The BPFSC is 24 questions, so that can take a while, too. And this is then just a very brief screen of the MSI to help people do a quick assessment of BPD. And here again, we try to establish the MSI and also see whether the cutoff for adolescents is the same that was established for adults. The participants, this was not from the Menninger Clinic. We recruited these participants from the Harris County Psychiatric Center, which is serving the indigenous population in Houston, so much more diverse sample. And then on slide 44, we see correlations with the BPFSC and the CIBPD. And on slide 45, you see the ROC curve, and you see a very nice curve there for the MSI moving towards the left-hand corner. And we establish a cutoff that is a bit lower than in adults. So the cutoff in adults is 7. You'll see where those two lines for sensitivity and specificity cross on slide 45. It's actually around 5.5. So it suggests that there's a lower threshold for BPD when working in adolescents. So on slide 46, thank you for hanging in there with the dry psychometrics. Our work so far, we wanted to say or examine, can one accurately assess and identify BPD in adolescents? And the answer to that question is yes. So we want to now move on to the second question. How does one understand the development of or early precursors of BPD in adolescents? So if we go on to slide 49, we see that one major etiological pathway for BPD has been through interpersonal functioning. And I've just pasted some pictures of some movies that have depicted extreme cases of BPD, Angelina Jolie in Girl Interrupted and Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction. These are extreme caricatures of BPD, but it does capture some of the stereotypes of BPD, as do some of the popular psychology books like Stop Walking on Eggshells or I Hate You, Don't Leave Me. These are caricatures. However, it is true that empirical research shows a greater number of breakups, impairment in social relationships, lower marital satisfaction in adults with BPD. Also, in the children in the community study, Pat Cohen's big longitudinal study, actually the only big longitudinal study that was so far, we've seen luckily some good prospective studies come out recently, but the CIC has been the hallmark study for many years. Also, in the CIC, it was shown that borderline traits in adolescents would predict breakdown of relationships in young adulthood. Nikki Creek's study in 2005, which had a longitudinal component, she also showed that children with BPD traits showed hostile attributional biases in their peer relations and enmeshment with best friends. The DSM-4 also really captures a lot of the interpersonal functioning in its criteria. I'm not going to go through all of them, but basically 8 of the 9 criteria relate to interpersonal functioning or the interpersonal context in which some of the BPD symptoms express themselves. So on to slide 51 then. I want us to just stand still there a little bit. One theoretical approach to understanding this interpersonal problems and challenges in BPD or associated with BPD has been Peter Fonagy's model of mentalization, and this is a very nice visual representation of the model that was published in Development and Psychopathology by Peter Fonagy and Patrick Lighton in 2009, and there you'll see distal factors and proximal factors and then the BPD core features. The distal factors then are all related with either one of two things: constitutional factors, which is temperamental sensitivity in the same way that Marsha Linehan would talk about it, just a sensitive child who is easily dysregulated emotionally, combined with an early caregiving context that did not fit the child's temperament. Then the proximal factors are stress and arousal. So we've got the distal factors that lie dormant, latent, and these are switched on by immediate stress, proximal stress in the environment, that which then lead to the BPD core features. If we then unpack the distal factors, that you'll see at the bottom left-hand corner, there's a little, almost like a little engine, a reciprocal process that happens that starts off with attachment disruption. And remember, we said that typically what would happen is just a bad fit between a child's temperament and a parent's ability to respond to that temperament, which then leads to attachment disruptions in the relationship, which leads to poor self-other differentiation. So the infant, the toddler, the preschooler has difficulty knowing what is my mind and what is my mom's mind or my dad's mind, because the attachment wasn't secure. This leads to hypersensitivity to mental states, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, what that means. We call it also hypermentalizing. This then leads to a low threshold for attachment activation and controlled mentalization deactivation. So in other words, when stress occurs, mentalization may break down in the form of hypermentalizing, which then in turn leads again to emotion dysregulation, impairment in integration of cognition and affect. And this kind of central engine then keeps the disorder going and leads to the full core features that you see on the right-hand side. Now, this is a model that was presented, and there's some data in adults for pieces of this. If we go to slide 52, for instance, linking attachment disruption with borderline features, there's actually a good literature for this. But nothing in teens. The other part of the model that we validated was in teenagers was a hypermentalizing BPD link. And so I'm just going to explain the task to you briefly. We show a video clip, a movie to the teenagers. This is a task developed by Isabel Diabex called the Movie Assessment for Social Cognition. And we show them a movie with four characters, Sandra, Betty, Cliff, and Michael. On slide 55, you will see, let's move to slide 56. The scene, for instance, from clip A would be a young and attractive woman named Sandra opens the front door. Upon opening the door, a man who looks to be around the same age as Sandra enters the house. Before she can answer or say hello, he tells her that she looks terrific. He asks whether she did something with her hair, and then she touches her hair and starts to say something, but he interrupts her again and compliments her by telling her that her hair looks very classy. And so, of course, they watch this video. We don't really give them a narrative. And then we stop it and we say, well, what is Sandra feeling at this point in time? A, her hair does not look that nice. B, she's pleased about his compliment. C, she's exasperated about Michael coming on too strong, or D, she's flattered about, but somewhat taken by surprise. And these are all different types of mentalizing responses. A would be a no mentalizing response because the response does not include any mental states whatsoever. So we would imagine that an autistic person would choose that. B is she's pleased about his compliment. There is some mental state reference there, but it's under-mentalizing because she doesn't really look pleased. She looks a little bit awkward. She doesn't really look pleased about his compliment. C, she's exasperated about Michael coming on too strong. This is this could be how she feels, but the data, it goes a little bit about beyond the data. So it's an over-attribution of mental states, and we call that hyper-mentalizing. Finally, D, she's flattered, but somewhat taken by surprise, so a little bit awkward about the whole situation, is then the correct response. And so what we found was when we presented this to the teenagers, the scale, the theory of mind or mentalizing scale that uniquely associated with BPD was C, hypermentalizing, not undermentalizing, not no mentalizing, not correct mentalizing, but this C, this hypermentalizing would really fit well with Fonagy's model. We next then wanted to consider affect. We wanted to consider emotion regulation. And again, despite the wonderful theoretical foundation of this by Marshall Linehan and some studies linking attachment to BPD, there's been very few studies examining attachment, emotion regulation, and BPD in teenagers. So this is what we set out to do. You can see there on slide 59, we really wanted to hit those three developmental precursors, attachment disruption, hypermentalizing, and emotion dysregulation, and how that relates to BPD. And we, of course, hypothesized that the relationship between attachment disruption and BPD features would be mediated by theory of mind, hypermentalizing, and then emotion dysregulation. On slide 60, you can see our sample. I'm going to speed up a little bit so that I can get to the findings. We use the child attachment interview, a wonderful interview-based measure that's modeled on the AAI, the adult attachment interview. We use the MASC again. We use the DERS and the BPFSC that I've talked about. And when we put them all, I'm going to jump to 63, when we put them all into a multimediational model, what we saw was that hypermentalizing mediated the link between attachment and borderline features, but not emotion dysregulation. In defense of emotion dysregulation, this is a self-report measure. It is not as sophisticated as the experimentally based hypermentalizing measure that we used. So a next study should definitely use an experimentally based emotion dysregulation task to see, and then we may see that we get this multi-mediation. At this stage, we got the hypermentalizing mediating the link between attachment and BPD features. So the conclusions then of this study that we're busy writing up for publication is that it's the first study to empirically test models that examine the proposition that theory of mind or mentalizing should be predicted by or relate to attachment schemas in adolescents. Previous studies have looked at other social cognitive constructs, but this is the first one to look at mentalizing. It's also the first study to test this developmental model and show it, and then to have NZ mentalizing and ER emotion regulation complete. And then just finally here, in terms of this interpretation of all of this, for the longest time people have thought that people with BPD have mentalizing deficits, but the research has been patchy. There's studies that even show that patients or individuals with BPD have superior mentalizing deficits. And what this research of ours starts to suggest is that perhaps where emotion dysregulation, Linehan's theory, and the mentalizing deficits, Fonagy's theory, meet is in the concept of hypermentalizing. And I'll be writing more about that in two papers that I hope will be coming out in the next few months. So just coming back to where we wanted to be or what we wanted to do in our research program, our second point then, how does one understand the development or early precursors? We see that it is potentially one pathway through this interpersonal social cognitive pathway. On to 67, clearly we are focused on these first two points, but many other people are working on these other points, and we are trying to work at this. Follow-up studies are hard to do, but we're certainly working on 3 and 5 at the moment as well. And then finally, we're doing this really to have that translational pathway from understanding the basics of the disorders through to what could help and predict recovery. And I'll leave it at that so we have a bit of time for questions.
Well, thank you. A couple of questions.
Sure.
One is on your item response analysis, were you able to do that with you did it with boys and girls. Were you able to do it with ethnic groups, Hispanics, Asians, and so forth?
We were not. So this is an English sample, and there was such a, I'm going to quickly go back. They were actually 96% of the sample was Caucasian. And because it's English, you would find low numbers of Hispanic population. But in England, of course, there's a lot of Asians. And Middle Eastern Asians as well, but the sample size was so small that we didn't test for that with a 4% consisting of many different ethnic children with ethnic backgrounds. So no, we didn't test for that, and that is definitely needed.
Okay. Does the DSM-5 group know of these results, to your knowledge?
I am not sure about that. I have not explicitly talked to them, but I think some of the members have certainly heard pieces of this. I am actually presenting part of our IRT. We've now done IRT on 3 samples, this one that's already published. We're doing IRT on our inpatient sample, and we've got an adult borderline sample from the Menninger Clinic, and I'll be presenting this data in April at the NASPD conference in Boston. I know that some of the DSM-5 folks will be there, so hopefully they'll be more aware of this results when we get there.
Yeah, because your work is part of a growing body that really kind of demolishes the delaying of a borderline diagnosis until early adulthood.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we know that the DSM-4 allows diagnosis of PPD before 18 if it is there for 1 year and if it is coherent and pervasive. But I do think we need guidance or should present guidance in the future that will allow clinicians to feel less reluctant about at least putting down traits or emerging BPD. At the Menier Clinic, we often talk about emerging BPD rather than full-blown BPD so that kids can get the right treatment.
Okay, another question. If a parent, child, adolescent child, has symptoms that suggest BPD, how can they most effectively pursue this, advocate with a clinician to look for a BPD diagnosis?
That is such a good question, and I would encourage the clinician to ask the clinician to assess for BPD explicitly. Let the clinician know that there are good and validated measures, as I presented here today, that can reliably and validly assess and identify where a child or an adolescent lie on the continuum of BPD, and encourage the clinician to use these validated measures so that you've got data on your side, so that you've got numbers on your side. I think that's one way of doing it that could help.
Hello. we have to talk about some kids. Here they are. What about the treatment implications here with adolescents? Have you intersected with that? Are the adult treatments? I'm trying to rephrase something here. Are the adult treatments generally directly applicable and appropriate, or do we need modifications?
They do need modifications. So people are doing really good work in this area. So Alec Miller is doing really good adaptations of DBT. Blaise Aguirre in Boston is doing really good adaptations. I think there are some, and then for MBT, the mentalization-based therapy, Trudy Rousseau, there are people, she's been adapting it to kids in a very manualized way. Liz Newlin at the ATP, at the Adolescent Treatment Unit at the Menninger has been developing a manual. So, and all over the world, there are pockets of people adjusting it for adolescents. And, of course, the big issue is developmental appropriate material. So thinking about the adolescent's world, thinking about what's important to them, talking to them in a language that is accessible and understandable. But people are doing good work at adapting this for adolescents, adolescent populations. And I would say DBT and MBT. I should also just let everybody know, Jennifer Tackett, a colleague of mine at UH, and I are now in the final stages almost of editing. We've just got the chapter deadline was the 1st of November for us to get chapters in. We've, with Springer, doing a handbook of borderline personality disorder in children and adolescents, and we hope it will be published and coming out in August. And we've got a wonderful section on that covers all the main treatment approaches for BPD, from MBT, DBT, also transference-focused therapy, the STEPS program, working with families. So we've got a big section in the book for talking about adolescent appropriate applications of well-validated adult treatments.
That's great. One, I hope, quick question. Do you have a sense, does borderline symptoms pop, do they pop out kind of with the transition, hormonal transition to adolescence, or do we have significant precursors in childhood?
We have very limited data. My suspicion at the moment is that from clinical anecdotal evidence is that we probably will see some temperamental issues that were noticed early on, just sensitivity, difficulty regulating emotion, perhaps pre-adolescence, but nothing that would warrant necessarily a diagnosis at that point at all. But then with the transition to adolescence, absolutely. I think with the physiological changes that takes place, which increases the risk for internalizing problems, and then the social changes that take place, which, you know, becomes very complicated to navigate for someone who is interpersonally sensitive. If you combine those two things, then you get the combination of the internalizing and externalizing symptoms that we see developing in BPD. So absolutely, I think we should put our efforts at adolescence. This is the place where we will probably be able to intervene most effectively.
Great. Thank you so much for a very informative session. And next week, for our callers, we will be on Thanksgiving vacation, but we will resume in December, first Sunday in December, with a presentation on genetics by Tim Troll. Fascinating work coming out of the genetics inquiries concerning the disorder. And remember, when you call in to listen, when you use the web page, including for past call-ins that are there with audio recordings, think of it as buying a book or a magazine and make a donation to the NEA BBT. There's a easy to use little donation button on the right hand side, and you can do it by credit card or PayPal. And because there are fixed costs to keep this all available. Everybody have a great Thanksgiving, and tune in early December. Bye-bye.
Thanks, bye-bye. Jim. Thanks, Carlos, so much. This was wonderful.
Thank you, guys.
Good night.
It was a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.